giants and the Nephilim. The discussion of angels is a lead-in to identifying the giants of Genesis and taking a look at the concept of the Nephilim. To start the discussion, we had to identify the sons of God mentioned in Genesis and their offspring as also discussed. Are the sons of God angels who have fallen? We have information about angels who sinned and what became of them. Peter states, God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to hell, and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment in 2 Peter 2:4. Jude also writes about this, stating, and the angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness unto the judgment of the great day, in Jude 6. Let's sort this out. Angels who sinned aren't described as fallen in these passages. They sinned. When they sinned or didn't keep their first estate, they didn't transform themselves into human-like beings, move to earth, and then mate with human women. They were bound by God at His command, collected, and cast into a place referred to as hell or darkness. They're bound with chains of darkness and cannot escape their situation. Why? Because they've been reserved in that state for the coming judgment, the judgment at the end of time when God ends everything. Second, we have to remember that angels don't marry, nor are they given in marriage in Matthew 22:30 and Mark 12:25. A principal function of marriage is that of procreation. Angels, according to Christ, do not have this ability or capability by their nature. The idea of angels being fallen in the book of Enoch in popular interpretations is that they had the ability to rebel against God, and part of that rebellion was to transform themselves into beings that had human-like passion and desire to produce offspring. If we limit what we know about angels and their status in a fallen state, then we have to constrain what we know to the facts as given. Angels sinned. They were collected and bound in chains of darkness. They were placed in a spiritual realm from which there's no escape. How do we know that? In Luke, when Lazarus and the rich man die, we see Lazarus in the bosom of Abraham, where he's comforted while the rich man is in torment. When the rich man asks Abraham to send Lazarus with a drop of water to cool his tongue, Abraham responds, "Between us and you there's a great gulf fixed, so that they which would pass from hence to you cannot, neither can they pass to us that would come from thence," in Luke 16:26. Lazarus and the rich man are human, but the principle logically can be understood to be the same. When a soul or an angel has been consigned to a place of waiting for judgment, good or bad, there's no leaving to return to another realm. God is the ruler of all this, and these are His sanctions and can't be violated. So, if the sons of God aren't angels, who or what are they? In all my lessons on the Scriptures, I constantly point in the direction of the context. The context will determine how we interpret passages. We can define context as the conditions or environment that words, phrases, or in the case of the Bible, entire books occur in. This environment defines what we're reading and therefore identifies limits to our interpretation. There are several elements that make up the context. We can summarize these as the time period during which events occur or are recorded, the audience being addressed, the subject under consideration, and the law in effect at the time. The time period under consideration in Genesis 6 is the patriarchal period, and specifically the period before the flood. The antediluvian period ends with the flood sent in the days of Noah, and so the subject being discussed is the development of humans on the earth and their conduct at that time. The law, in effect, was verbally transmitted to the heads of households, making this a unique period in the world. The record states, "And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose," in Genesis 6, 1-2. There are two groups identified, men who multiply and the sons of God. Interpretations of this passage assume there's a difference between these two groups and concludes that the second represents supernatural beings. If we back up in the book a bit, we find there's another explanation that fits the narrative well. Remember, Cain killed Abel over his sacrifice being rejected by God. From that time on, Cain shows a preference to focus on himself, not God, or the laws that the Lord has given. Following the murder of Abel, Cain went out from the presence of the Lord in Genesis 4:17 and had children. His offspring are listed for several generations in Genesis 4:17 through 24, and that's the last we hear about his descendants in a specific sense. In Genesis 4:25 through 26, there's a shift in the focus. This shift will be critical not only to the events that take place in the next few chapters, but will have much to do with the entire narrative and the messianic strain. We read, "And Adam knew his wife again, and she bare a son, and called his name Seth. For God, said she, hath appointed me another seed instead of Abel, whom Cain slew," in Genesis 4:25. The next verse begins the record of the lineage of Seth, and there's a subtle change that takes place. "And to Seth, to him also there was born a son, and he called his name Enos. Then began men to call upon the name of the Lord," in Genesis 4:26. Enos is the firstborn of Seth, and it will be the family of Seth that will bring Abraham, Israel, and Christ into the world. Note the next statement. "Then began men to call upon the name of the Lord," in Genesis 4:26. Chapter 5 continues with a genealogy of the family of Adam tracing the descendants of Seth. The chapter ends with our introduction to Noah. Genesis 6 begins with a view of the state of the world, and we're told about two groups of people, men in Genesis 6:1 and the sons of God in Genesis 6:2. The interpretation to explain this is that the designation of men refers to mortal humans, and the sons of God denotes beings who are of a more supernatural nature or fallen angels. I believe if we keep this in context, we can see what this points to. There are two genealogies listed between Genesis 4 and 5. Genesis 4 speaks of the descendants of Cain, individuals who apparently followed their progenitors' rejection of God and continued to follow their own willfulness. In Genesis 5, we have the sons of Seth, who are said to be calling on the name of the Lord. Some translations render this with slight variations, but the implication is that they are mindful of the Lord, at least in the beginning. So there are two branches of Adam's family tree, one that rejected God and pursued their own interests, and a second that starts out calling on the name of the Lord or following Him. But note the shift in chapter 6. Men multiply on the face of the earth and have daughters that attract the attention of the sons of God, or godly patriarchs, who start out on a good path but quickly stray. And we know the nature of their deviation. They see the daughters of men, descendants of the bloodline of Cain, and they took them wives of all which they chose, in Genesis 6:2. Why is that a problem? God created the first couple, Adam and Eve, and brought them together, physically modeling the nature of marriage, its blessings, and purpose. One man was to marry one woman, and they were to remain faithful to each other. In Genesis 6, we see godly patriarchs allowing themselves to be overcome with lust, taking multiple wives, violating the marriage law, and being influenced by those who had already rejected God. God recognizes this as wickedness in Genesis 6:5, and limits humans' lifespan to 120 years. Now, you may still be thinking that some of these beings are fallen angels, but the chapter has enough information to clarify that the sons of God are human patriarchs. The key is in the observation God makes that I just referenced. "And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually," in Genesis 6:5. Reading this carefully, we can confirm that the individuals mentioned in the chapter are human. First, God recognizes the wickedness of man. There are two groups, men and the sons of God. If one of these groups was made up of angelic beings, wouldn't God call them out in the observation and let us know who we're dealing with? But that doesn't happen. Instead, we see the root of this wickedness is in the imagination of men. There's no distinction here between men and the sons of God, leading me to conclude that both groups are human and not angels or fallen supernatural beings. Men were to lead their families and be spiritual guides with their wives working with and supporting them. It's not hard to come to a conclusion that the godly patriarchs corrupted themselves, were influenced by ungodly individuals, pursued their lust, violating marriage and engaging in violence. And where unrestrained lust is present, we'll find greed, anger, and hate flourishing as well. The story shows that human nature hasn't changed since the beginning of time. So that leads us to another dilemma in the description in Genesis chapter 6 that's also part of the interpretations being applied to the end times today. And that is the mention of giants. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown, in Genesis 6:4. The construction in this case is being interpreted to mean that the sons of God, fallen angels, mate with human women, and their offspring are giants with superhuman ability. Let's apply the reasoning I've been following to this and see what we have. First, giants were a reality. They were the product of the union of the sons of God, patriarchs, and women, so therefore are also human. These giants were in the world before the flood and also afterwards. We have to ask, does the Bible ever define the characteristics of these giants so we know who or what we're dealing with? The answer to that is yes. I'll go over these with some examples and then come back to the latter part of the verse. Giants in the Bible are known by a few names according to their genealogy. We have the Anakim in Numbers 13:33 and Deuteronomy 9:2 and the Rephaim that are mentioned as well. We also have close-up views of individuals who were giants that gives us a frame of reference. One of the first of these is Og, the king of Bashan, that Israel defeated as they wandered in the wilderness. For only Og, king of Bashan, remained of the remnant of giants. Behold, his bedstead was a bedstead of iron. Is it not in Rabbah of the children of Ammon? 9 cubits was the length thereof, and 4 cubits the breadth of it after the cubit of man, in Deuteronomy 3:11. The record identifies that Og is the last of the race of giants to which he belonged. His bedstead is made of iron to support his massive size and weight. The length of the bed is given as 9 cubits, which would be somewhere around 12 to 13 feet. Perhaps one of the most well-known of the giants is introduced during the reign of King Saul. And there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span, in 1 Samuel 17:4. Calculating the average length of a cubit to be approximately 1.5 feet, or 18 inches, Goliath would stand around 10 feet tall, of giant proportions but far from the 300 cubits noted in the book of Enoch. Another giant in the service of the Philistines that was killed in battle is named as war continued with Israel. And Ishbibenob, which was of the sons of the giant, the weight of whose spear weighed 300 shekels of brass in weight, he being girded with a new sword thought to have slain David in 2 Samuel 21:16. This giant is killed before he can find and slay David, resulting in a directive from David's men that he was no longer to go into battle, so the enemy could quench not the light of Israel in 2 Samuel 21:17. The record continues as battles ensue with the Philistines. And it came to pass after this that there was again a battle with the Philistines at Gob. Then Sibekai the Hushathite slew Saph, which was of the sons of the giant, in 2 Samuel 21:18. In a later battle, the brother of Goliath is mentioned as well. And there was again a battle in Gob with the Philistines, where Elhanah, the son of Jerioregan, a Bethlehemite, slew the brother of Goliath the Gittite, the staff of whose spear was like a weaver's beam, in 2 Samuel 21:19. The height of the giant isn't given, but we can conclude that he was nearly as tall as Goliath based on the reference to the weaver's beam. Again, his stature would have been a far cry from the 450-foot-tall giants mentioned in the book of Enoch. A fourth giant is referenced in this same chapter as the narrative describes ongoing conflict with the Philistines. And there was yet a battle in Gath, where was a man of great stature, that had on every hand 6 fingers and on every foot 6 toes, 24 in number, and he also was born to the giant in 2 Samuel 21:20. Note the reference to the giant in this passage. We have another note about this at the end of the chapter. These 4 were born to the giant in Gath and fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants in 2 Samuel 21:22. Taking this information, we can learn much about the existence of giants. The 4 giants recorded in 2 Samuel are the sons of the giant, as I just read. This means that they were all related. It's interesting that only one is referred to as the brother of Goliath, but if the 4 mentioned in this chapter were born of one giant, then they're siblings, which indicates that Goliath was of the same family. From our knowledge of modern genetics and inheritance, we can construct a realistic view of who the giants were and how they came to be. The family of humans began with 2 people, Adam and Eve. As they lived, they had children, obviously more than the sons recorded. Siblings would by necessity have had to marry if we restrict our knowledge to the scriptural narrative. Genetically, the gene pool would have been pristine in early generations. However, since man was driven from the garden and subject to physical degeneration and death, other things, such as genetic mutations or changes, would begin to emerge, manifesting in such traits as giantism. The language of Genesis 6 and the passages describing the giants in the days of David, to me, implies that giantism was a relatively rare anomaly that appeared and may have been restricted to certain families. This would give rise to giants, such as the Anakim and Rephaim that are mentioned. The family of Goliath indicates this indeed wasn't the norm for all people, and the presence of other mutations, such as polydactyly, mentioned in 2 Samuel, reinforces this idea. From a scientific perspective, giantism would probably be a recessive trait, which would account for the isolated or restrictive number of giants. Genetics would also explain why and how there were giants before and after the flood, as noted in the record as well. The biggest takeaway for me is that the giants in these passages aren't superhuman beings with special powers. They're human, just bigger and stronger than other people. In battle, they were killed just as any other soldier would have been. In the world today, there are groups of people who are taller in stature than others, a trait that identifies them along with other physical characteristics. There are giants that have been noted in various countries, some of which have become actors or athletes. Archaeologists have unearthed evidence of giants who lived in various regions of the world in the past. Genetic mutations such as this are often accompanied by other problems or instabilities in the giant's physical makeup. We've seen the biblical notation of a polydactyl giant, but other issues have plagued some considered giants in recent years, such as cardiac, circulatory, and other problems. Giantism may have been more prolific in the early days of the earth and creation, but it may be represented by a physical and genetic frailty that resulted in a high mortality rate compared to other humans. That, not a spiritual cleansing or war, may be the reason why these people died out over time. To further separate fantasy from reality, the Genesis record provides another clue about the identity of the giants in God's observation of the state of the world. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth in Genesis 6:5. There's no distinction between the giants mentioned earlier in verse 4 and other inhabitants. They're all included under the term man. This distinction is also absent as God reaches a conclusion about what he'll do. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth in Genesis 6:6. The conclusion holds as we see that man includes all inhabitants of the earth, including the giants, and that God made them. The giants aren't the result of rogue angels whose sin was that of lust and transformation into creatures that had the capacity to mate with human females and sire children. We don't know what the angels' sin was, but we do know from the scriptures that when they sinned, they weren't homesteading on earth with the wife. They were bound in chains of darkness, being tormented, as they waited for the final judgment, which hasn't taken place. This explanation to me makes sense and preserves the context not only of Genesis, but of the rest of the Scriptures. During the intertestamental period, there were those who took it on themselves to write explanations of things. Some are historical and have value, while others are esoteric volumes that detail things that no one else did. The writers of the Book of Enoch aren't identified. The narrative is distinctly different from the writings found in the Old Testament. Aspects of the Book of Enoch reveal things that create conflicts with the canonical scriptures and have no apparent connection to the greater biblical narrative. I see this book as similar to people today who write about ghosts, hauntings, and other paranormal phenomena. The content exists more in the mind of the authors than in revelation or reality, but it does demonstrate that some people consider something true if they can convince others that it's credible. Put simply, if I can get someone to believe something, then that means it's true, or they wouldn't accept it. Pseudo-credibility, in the absence of textual or physical evidence, is often taken as fact and verified through personal experience or how one feels about the content. Subjective feelings are not a reliable standard to use when attempting to establish objective truth. The idea of the giants being Nephilim, the superhuman offspring of supernatural beings and human women, violates the evidence that I've discussed. To the contrary, we find that the idea of the Nephilim, or fallen ones, aren't superhuman individuals whose presence in the world will signal doom for the planet. I'll cover that as the study progresses. In a broader sense, the idea of fallen ones could correctly be applied to all of humanity, with the exception of Noah, who found grace in the sight of the Lord in Genesis 6:8. Finally, we can dispel the notion that the presence or appearance of giants or Nephilim will signal the end of the world because Christ stated there won't be a sign of the end. In order to understand this, we need to review the dispensations of biblical time and how prophecy relates to them.